ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, I'm Alicia Simmons.
And I'm Lee Boucher.
As historians, we've spent years digging into the lives of people who've changed history, for better or for worse.
So naturally, we are extremely qualified to gossip about them.
And because they're dead, they can't sue.
In our podcast, we sift through Australia's most notable and notorious characters, giving you our unfiltered takes.
Find it by searching for The Dead Can't Sue on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. Concert ticket stubs, a couple of lines scrawled on a piece of yellowing paper, an old lamp. At first glance, these objects might be junk. They certainly have no monetary value. But when there's a memory attached to them, they suddenly become priceless. That's the heart of an upcoming exhibition, which I'll tell you about soon. And I would love to hear about your own priceless artifacts too in the next 20 minutes. Also ahead, dream big, aim high. You can do anything you set your mind to. Like me, you might have grown up hearing messages like that. They are intended to be encouraging. But if you tell someone they can be anything, can it do more harm than good? It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, a few weeks ago, you may have heard that smoking rates had fallen to a historic low. The data from the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare revealed just 5.6% of Australians over 14 were smoking daily last year, putting us very close to our target of 5% by 2030. But we also know a huge chunk of the nicotine products in the country are from illicit sources, an estimated 80% of them, according to the Australian Bureau of Statistics last year. So if illegal tobacco is on the rise, but smoking rates are declining, do we really have a clear picture on who is smoking and how much? Are the levers we've been pulling so far to try and reduce smoking still working? Well, you're about to hear from a couple of researchers with ideas on what we could do differently in just a sec, but I do want to hear from you too. Have you been priced out of buying cigarettes legally? Has the cost of quitting products kept you from trying to ditch the smokes? Here with me is Ed Jegasorthy, a senior lecturer in the School of Public Health at the University of Sydney. Ed, welcome to Life Matters.
Thanks, Tegan.
So when you saw the release of this data, as a public health researcher, were you like, yeah, we're doing it, 5.6%, let's go?
Look, that was definitely my initial reaction. I thought it was a really positive direction, especially in the global context and Australian context as well. That was my initial reaction, of course. However, my scepticism started to creep when I looked at the other results from other state surveys, which showed much higher rates of smoking, so around sort of 9% in New South Wales and Queensland and Victoria. So if the Queensland, the three biggest states in the country have a daily smoking rate of 9%, but the national estimate is 5.6%, they both can't be correct. And you can see some variation between surveys because of different methods and different populations, but not that large, and not that large in direction as well. So we're seeing a sort of a steep fall off a cliff at the national level, but then with these state surveys, it's more of a gradual decline.
Why would the state numbers be so different to the national ones?
So there's a couple of reasons why that might be. And as I said, it could be survey methodology, but this growth in the black market has many, many costs associated with it. And one of those costs is that we have less of a clear idea of who is smoking, because people begin to answer questions differently in surveys as time goes on if they're more likely to be smoking illicit substances.
Sure.
So people are, you know, following a social desirability bias and are less likely to give truthful answers if they're doing something that's socially stigmatized or illegal.
Why would they be saying it more accurately at the state level than at the national level, though, if they're scared?
Look, that's right. And that's an interesting question. And I don't really have the answer to that. But the question I would pose is, is it more likely to be an overestimate or an underestimate? And an underestimate is more likely to be the case.
So basically what you're saying is that illicit tobacco is potentially obscuring higher smoking rates than we thought, and maybe we're not having as much success as we thought. what do we do about that? What, from a public health perspective, what do you want to do about that?
Well, the real issue here is that the illicit tobacco market, illicit nicotine market, basically circumvents all the policies that are currently in place. So the high taxes, the restrictions on vapes, plain packaging, graphic warnings, they're all being circumvented by the illicit market, which continues to grow and is dominant. So that means that the policies themselves can't be driving down smoking rates because people aren't really being affected by those policies. People aren't being affected by, aren't deterred by high price because you can get cigarettes for quite cheap. People aren't being deterred by from vaping because of restrictions to pharmacies because you can get them anywhere and with all the different flavours and colouring and packaging that the illicit market provides. So we actually need to get the illicit market under control before we can really think about how we get the how we actually control tobacco and nicotine in the country.
Well, also here with us is James Martin, Associate Professor of Criminology at Deakin University. The two of you, along with a colleague, have co-authored a piece in The Conversation recently. James, we're hearing Ed saying we've got to get illicit tobacco under control if we're going to make a difference. What would that look like?
Good morning, Tegan. Yeah, that's a great question. And we're seeing lots of activity at the federal and state level at the moment to try and get the illicit market under control. And it's really centred almost exclusively around increased enforcement. So that's, inspection teams going out, product seizures, raids, that sort of things, you know, whether at the border or trying to shut down shops. But the problem with this kind of approach is that large-scale illicit markets, and we certainly have an extraordinarily large illicit nicotine market, one that rivals most of the illicit drugs put together in terms of size and profitability. Enforcement doesn't really work against markets that big because there are so many players in the market, there's so many profits to be made. Anytime a shop is closed down or an importation syndicate is arrested and thrown in prison, there's a long queue of other people who are ready to step in and fill that gap.
So if enforcement's not going to do the job, what will?
Well, the best way to fight a black market is to actually have a well-functioning legal one. And that's really, I think, the thrust of our argument here is that we've tightened the screws so much on the legal tobacco and nicotine industries. And historically, that's, you know, been a wise and well-advised thing to do. But in the current context, when we have 80% of the nicotine products supplied in the country, that's actually really punishing legal suppliers, which plays directly into the hands of organised crime. So what we're arguing is that we need to reduce tobacco excise substantially and also legalise less harmful nicotine products such as vapes and nicotine pouches, emulating approaches that we see in other countries such as New Zealand or the UK that actually use these less harmful nicotine products to give people a platform or a pathway out of smoking.
This is a pretty controversial take. It pretty much goes against what the public health, the way the public health winds have been blowing at the moment. Ed, what kind of reaction have you had from colleagues when you've put these ideas forward?
Look, I've had a fair bit of pushback from some colleagues in public health, but then quietly behind closed doors, I get a lot of support. There is a lot of contention around these policies, but I totally understand why. Strong advocates like the Cancer Council and various academics and different organisations are reluctant to blame their policies that they have fought really hard for against, you know, industry lobbying and against all these corporate forces. I can see why they're reluctant to attribute this problem to their policies. I can understand that entirely, but it doesn't mean that's not true. So we do actually have to revisit these policies and understand that that is going to be distasteful for those policymakers.
I mean, you mentioned the Cancer Council there. We did invite them to be part of this conversation. They weren't able to put forward a spokesperson at this time, but I did speak to the chair of their public health committee last year, Anita Desai, and here's a little bit of what she told me when we were talking about price.
Price has been an important measure, and so any suggestion by industry or retailer front groups that we should be you know, halving or reducing it back to the price of the early 2000s is ridiculous. But we also know that other policy measures like smoke-free environments have also played a really important role in driving down smoking rates. So the focus isn't just on price, it's a focus on making sure that we're doing everything that we can to help drive down smoking rates, encourage smokers to quit, and provide those proven effective methods to support smokers to quit.
So like a portfolio of measures then, Ed?
Yeah, that's right. So look, there's a lot of policies that are in place and a lot of them came in around the same time. So during the 2000s and 2010s, we saw Smoke-Free Environment Act, we saw plain packaging and graphic warnings, we saw lots of television campaigns and advertising campaigns to get people to quit smoking and quit campaigns as well. So all of these policies and programs were put in place around the same time and were effective as a suite of policies to reduce smoking rates. Now, the tax in and of itself hasn't really been shown to be terribly effective in reducing smoking rates. It's difficult to sort of isolate it as a particular policy, but the tax has increased really dramatically from 2010 to 2020. And during that time, we didn't see a really dramatic acceleration in the decline in smoking prevalence, which we should have expected to see given that the tax went from 30 cents to $1.50 in that period. So, and the tax itself was justified as, you know, being a very regressive tax that it hits people with on low incomes the hardest. It was justified based on the fact that, or the assumption that people on low incomes would be more price sensitive, and that was not the case. So, people on low incomes have reduced smoking rates much slower than those on higher incomes. And when it comes to that suite of policies, most of the other policies are still in place. So if we were to reduce the tax, all of the other policies are still in place. And by saying that we can't cut tax because it would undermine the policies, kind of undermines those other policies as well.
You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm talking to Ed Jegasothy, a senior lecturer in the School of Public Health at the University of Sydney, and Dr. James Martin from Deakin University in criminology, talking about new data from the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare showing that Australian smoking rates are really, really low, close to our target, but perhaps that the huge amount of illicit tobacco in the country might be obscuring the true number of smokers. I'm really, really, really interested to hear from you about how you're using tobacco at the moment, what you're seeing, if that idea of low smoking rates rings true for you where you are. A lot of you are texting me. One says, as a health worker, I always ask people who admit smoking what sort of cigarettes they smoke. Every single one buys the illegal ones. Jara says, I'm a smoker, unfortunately. Absolutely cannot buy ciggies from a retailer these days. A packet is $43. Illegal pack is 16 to 22, so it's a no-brainer. The illegal retailer near me recently got closed down, but online, still very much available. And Joe says, I am a tobacco treatment specialist. We need to subsidise nicotine replacement therapy to assist quitting. Joe says, it's easier to smoke than it is to quit. So many different moving parts here, Ed, around what's driving people's behaviour.
That's right. And I think that's the really important thing to be thinking about here is that people smoke for many different reasons. People are actually getting something out of it. And the tax policy was driven by the assumption that, oh, it's just a rational consumption choice that you can just modify by increasing the price and people will just respond accordingly. But that what this black market explosion has shown is that those assumptions are untrue. And it's also evident in watching the smoking rates and how they've diverged across the socioeconomic spectrum over the last 20 years, that our assumptions are flawed, that this is not about rational, that this isn't about sort of economic rationality, and that people are, for the most part, actually trying to manage and adapt to their circumstances. And for a lot of people, smoking is a big part of that, and they're willing to pay a lot of money for those cigarettes, which they had done before the black market came along.
James, do people care whether they're buying legal or illegal tobacco ideologically?
Yeah, that's a great question, Tegan. And I think it's one of the main reasons we've seen such an explosion, not only in the consumption of illicit tobacco, but also on the supply side. So, you know, consuming illicit tobacco, I don't think for your average smoker is a big deal. I think there are, you know, are concerns about organised crime and contributing to that, but whether that's enough to incentivise people to pay, well, essentially, if you're a pack-a-day smoker, an extra $10,000 a year, you know, that's an extraordinary amount of money. So I don't think people are, you know, care that much that they're paid that sort of price difference. But on the supply side as well, this is really relevant. You know, we're at the moment where we're seeing this explosion in illicit retailing around the country, despite record levels of enforcement. And I think one of the reasons for that is selling illicit tobacco doesn't, even though it's attracting similar kinds of criminal penalties as selling things like illicit drugs, or, you know, methamphetamine or cannabis or whatever, there isn't the same kind of social stigma. Essentially, you're engaging in, you know, a sort of low-level, well, for consumers at least, low-level tax evasion. You know, this is a cash job that, you know, your tradie might do for you. And that's got a very different kind of connotation than someone who's trading in methamphetamine or child pornography or, you know, these really kind of heavily socially stigmatized and punished kinds of activities.
So there's a perception thing there. So, I mean, correct me if I'm misunderstanding your thesis. The idea is that we reduce or remove the tobacco excise. If we do that, James, aren't we just making it easier for big tobacco companies to turn a profit?
Well, I mean, that's one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is to say, well, what's actually going to be the most effective way to tackle organized crime? And we saw this with alcohol prohibition in the United States a century ago. People could say, okay, well, it's the alcohol lobby that wants you to re-legalize alcohol. But of course, you know, even though the industry did benefit from that, the real losers in that situation were Al Capone and the gangsters who had a dominant position in the supply of alcohol. And that's exactly what we've got at the moment. You know, 80% of the nicotine products sold in Australia are not supplied by big tobacco. They are marginal players in the contemporary nicotine landscape in Australia. The big suppliers are organised crime, and they are way worse players than the legal tobacco industry because, as Ed mentioned, they will sell exactly the same products, but they won't pay tax. They won't put health warnings on their products. They're happy to sell to kids. And also they use their violence to eliminate their competitors and, frankly, anyone who gets in their way.
You're telling me so many stories on the text line. Will says, my elderly mother who had quit smoking took it up again because of cheap and available illegal tobacco. Kate says the tobacco excise argument is a red herring. How will reducing to the tobacco excise reduce sales of vapes and nicotine products? One of your guests implied that vapes and other nicotine products are less harmful than cigarettes. A, vapes are harmful even if it's too early to say just how bad they are. B, smoking kills 2/3 of the people who do it. Even if the vapes are less harmful, they can still be pretty bad. Ed, does Kate have a point here?
So there is a point that we don't know exactly how harmful vapes are in the long term because we don't have long-term evidence, but all evidence points to vapes being much less harmful than smoking, and such that the UK and New Zealand have recommended people who smoke to switch to vapes. Now, the real risk that comes from vapes, and this is a lot of the evidence that underpins our policies in Australia, is based on risks associated with unregulated vapes. And the risks that associated with that, and in Australia, 95% of people are using unregulated vapes. We don't know what else is in them. They have high concentrations of nicotines. So they're really addictive. They're wide, you know, wide range of flavors and wide range of colors. And you know, as others have said, they appeal to kids. So it is the nature of the vapes, rather than vapes themselves, which is causing the most harm. And it's the illicit market which is producing those and providing those, supplying those products. And it is the restrictions on legal supply of regulated vapes which is facilitating the dominance of the illicit unregulated products, which are more harmful.
Ed, is there maybe a feeling like we've just tightened access to vapes in Australia, like the legal supply, so much more in the last few years? Is there a feeling of maybe like throwing our hands up and quitting with what we were aiming to do if we wind it back the way you're suggesting?
Look, I would actually flip it the other way. I think what we've been doing is being reactive to what we thought the problem was. We thought the problem was, oh, we didn't have enough restrictions, so we put more restrictions on. But the problem wasn't that we weren't restricted enough. The problem is that we were already too restricted, and that was causing the black market. So by turning the screws and creating more and more restrictions and removing more and more products from legal lists and removing more suppliers, legal suppliers, compliant suppliers, it gave more power to the illicit market.
Your perspective might be slightly controversial in public health perspectives, but certainly the message coming through on the text line is very much in line with what you're arguing for. One person says, I'm 70 years old, pack a day since I was 14, and now smoke illicit tobacco, as do nearly all my acquaintances. The balance is wrong, this person says. Policy and decision makers making the same mistake as the war on drugs, blind to their own failures. James, I'm interested to know, like, when you look at overseas countries and how they're managing smoking, are there different perspectives that we could consider?
Yeah, and I think this is, you know, something that just resonated, as you were saying, this is controversial in public health circles. It's controversial in Australian public health circles. But if you go to the real world leaders who, you know, like, well, I mean, Sweden became the first Western developed or comparable country to hit less than 5% daily smoking. They did that last year, and so they're now, you know, they've hit that smoke-free threshold. If you go to Sweden, cigarette prices, they're roughly third of what they are here. There's no real functioning illicit market. There's a huge legal regulated market for things like nicotine pouches and snus and vapes, and they have nicotine usage rates that are on par with the European average, but they've also got the lowest rates of smoking-related disease and death in Europe. And that's a really conscious health policy that is geared around harm reduction, saying, okay, people want to use appealing forms of nicotine, but let's try and encourage a shift towards less harmful products, and that's been incredibly successful. And so too do we see, you know, in places like the UK or New Zealand, both those countries actually have free switch to quit schemes where they give free vapes to smokers at taxpayer expense to get them to switch to less harmful products. And the messaging they have there is really simple, and that is, if you smoke, you should switch to vaping to decrease the risk to your health, and if you don't smoke, don't vape. Mm-hmm. So they've been very successful in diverting people towards those less harmful options. And we could see the same thing here if we embrace that harm reduction approach as well.
So, Ed, from a public health perspective, what do you see as the next step here?
Look, realistically what I think should happen, because, look, the government's been really steadfast on this. They're really keen to keep this whatever tax revenue they've got coming in, and they're really not keen at all on cutting the tax. But I think that's what needs to actually happen in order to actually get the black market under control. We need to change the model and remove all the incentives of the black market, all its advantages in terms of reducing the tax, but also providing regulated access to safer or less harmful nicotine replacement nicotine options. And those things need to happen. But ultimately, a lot of these driving forces of smoking and tobacco and nicotine use are structural drivers of inequality, poverty, marginalization, discrimination, and mental health, all of which we should be investing more in. And over the last 30 years, we've done a lot to reduce smoking rates directly through smoking policies, while we've seen job seeker languish, and while we've seen public housing lists and social housing lists waiting times grow. So we should be putting much more emphasis and investment into income support, welfare, housing, and other structural determinants of smoking.
One facet of a much bigger picture. Well, Ed, James, thank you both so much for chatting with me today. Ed Jegasothy is a senior lecturer in the School of Public Health at the University of Sydney. James Martin, associate professor in criminology at Deakin University. And thank you so much for your texts as well. Really fantastic getting your insights too from around Australia. Bill from Bangalore says, Australia's low smoking rates are due to the high cost. That's simple. What needs to happen is to increase the penalties and enforcement so that illegal ones are unavailable. That's also simple. Nerida says, I had been reducing smoking but increased after the influx of illegal tobacco. I'm managing to reduce again with a view to quit. And a secondary school teacher says, for many years, smoking has not been an issue in school. Since vapes came in, they've become an issue. Flavoured vapes are a marketing ploy to get young consumers hooked. Saying they're to help smokers is a con. Flavoured vapes should be illegal as they just target the youngsters. Well, you're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. Coming up next, is there an item in your house that no burglar would look twice at, but holds value that you can't put into dollars and cents? It's perhaps a little early in the day to be this much of a downer, but someday in the future, we'll all be gone. Our bones will be reduced to dust, our entire lives a mere blip in the vast history of the universe. And while you and I will be gone, there will be small objects that will outlive us and act as a reminder of who we were and how we lived. What will those objects be for you? Postcards maybe, or collectible teaspoons? The kinds of things that a burglar would never judge as having value in a robbery, but things so sentimental that money could never replace them. Well, there is a new exhibition coming up at the State Library of Victoria exploring the idea of memory and how the mundane objects of everyday life have stories to tell for future generations. I'll tell you more about the exhibition in a tick, and you'll also hear from an author who's become the custodian of some very special objects. But I would love to hear from you. Tell me about the seemingly ordinary objects that you've held on to that tell the story of your life or remind you of someone special. What is in your special keepsake box that's just gotten more valuable to you over time? And here with me is Roxanne Missingham, Chief Librarian at the State Library of Victoria. Roxanne, welcome back to Life Matters.
Oh, it's lovely to be here. Thank you, Tegan.
It's a delight to hear your voice. So you have picked through 4.5 million items in the library's collection. What are some of the objects that have stood out to you?
Oh, it was a very, very hard exercise. A lot of people contributed to this. And we have in what we call the Temple of Time so many different things. So I wanted to just start by highlighting one. We have a gold watch that belonged to Edward Living. And Edward Living was the man that took the Gerildery letter from Ned Kelly and brought it to Melbourne to the police. And when you read the stories of what was happening, Ned Kelly had a bit of a bonza day that day. He started off in the bank taking not just the money, but there was a family there who had their daughter's gold watch, so he snaffled that. Then later in the day, Steve Hart took the bank manager's watch and he took the Reverend Gribble's watch. And then the Reverend Gribble marched down to Ned Kelly and told him off for stealing the horse and stealing his watch. And Ned Kelly said to Steve Hart, as reported in the news of the time, "Why, the watch you took from this man," referring to the bank manager, "is a much better watch than this. Why can't you be satisfied with the watch you've got? And if you stick a man up for a watch, stick him up for a bleeping good one. Give the man back his watch." So not only does this watch tell the story of Living, but it tells the story of a rather feisty reverend and a whole lot of other things that were happening at the day.
That's amazing. So this, I mean, a watch is an object with value, clearly, because someone stole it, but yes, it's the story behind that makes it so special.
It is. And sometimes these treasures were not meant to last. So one of the things we have on display as well is a poster from the People for Nuclear Disarmament. And they were meant to be posted up on walls and then sort of die through the weather. And the one we have on display is a 1991 called Stop the War. And we call this material in the library ephemera. So it's material that's meant to be there for a short period of time. But if it's not collected, we'll lose that whole story of people and protests and the way they were using the street and their environment to communicate. So you never know what you've got in your garage that we might want.
Oh, good. Another reason to keep all my junk. How do I decide what in my garage is worth keeping and what really just needs to go out on curbside collection?
Many of the conversations we have with people are about what has meaning to them, what really speaks to the time that they lived in, what they record that was or their ancestors' record that gave a different insight. Sometimes when you think about libraries, you think we collect things by, you know, the great writers, people who made a real difference, politicians, philosophers, thinkers. But in fact, it's often the stories of ordinary people and the things they were observing or the things they were acting on that really tell something that no one else will have written down or have recorded.
Roxanne, I'm just thinking about things that are so special to me. And I remember when we were cleaning out my grandmother's house, the things that I found it really hard to let go of was anything with her handwriting on it. Oh, we found like an empty notebook, but that she'd written her name on the inside cover. And the idea of throwing that away was such a wrench, even though we had dozens of other books and recipe card libraries and all of that sort of thing. It's the idea that I suppose, that ephemeral nature of something, I suppose, is what kind of contributes to its value.
It is. And often it was something like the postcards. People wrote at the time of the adventures they were having going up to the Grampians and the going up by horse and cart and having a wild time. And you look at it now and think, oh, we could drive there in, you know, an hour, 40 minutes. But when you look back at the stories, and I love the photographs of the way people were dressed, the way they rode horses, had guns because they were shooting rabbits to have for dinner. And that sort of material is just amazing. And we do welcome people to come and talk to us about their collections. Some collections we encourage families to keep so that they keep that within their history. Public libraries are great collectors of historic information, and so are we.
Yeah, I'm interested to sort of, you've got watches and things that are in a library you often think of as a place where you collect written works or maybe illustrations, but you've got 3D objects as well as pieces of paper.
We do, and you just never know. So one of the fascinating collections that we have material from display on is a collection that was a man called Ian Banks, who was a taxi driver, and for 40 years he collected flyers, wrote notes, wrote how much he paid for petrol while he was driving people around, stories of the people he wanted, just on little pieces of paper and little notepads, and we have all of these beautifully sorted in the library that tell the story from the 1970s in particular in a great level of detail.
Beautiful. Well, you are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. The voice that you've been hearing is that of Roxanne Missingham, Chief Librarian at the State Library of Victoria, which has an exhibition about to open all about memories and the way we attach such strong memories to objects that otherwise don't have much innate value. I'd really love to know about the objects that you've held on to from your own life or from the life of someone that you love as a keepsake like that. One person says, the State Library of New South Wales has a collection of the stickers put on fruit. I'm glad I'm not in charge of cataloguing that. Another says, I have a piece of the Berlin Wall. Doing a Kentucky trip camping beside the wall, found a small chunk and carried it back to Australia. Well, also here with us is Cassie Gilmartin, a family historian whose upcoming book explores history through everyday objects. Perfect choice of book topic, Cassie.
It is. It's been wonderful writing it.
So tell me, you and your husband, Sean, have already written a guide to tracing ancestors through record books. Why is history so fascinating to you?
I think because it's endless. If I had to sum it up in one word, it's there's so many avenues that you can go down to find interesting things, and it gives you context around not only your ancestors and the time in which they lived, but it's the story of you as well. All those things, those decisions that they made, has impacted our own lives. And I find that just endlessly fascinating. We can learn so much from that everyday history.
So what kind of keepsakes have you got in your own family collection, Cassie?
I have a few things. And as you say, look, they're not of monetary value, but they're special to me because they're a tangible link back to my ancestors. And I think that's why people really connect with objects, because these are things that they're their loved ones held once, and now we have them as well. There's a real tangible connection. One of the objects I have is a photograph of my grandparents in 1940. It was the day that they picked up their engagement ring in George Street in Sydney. And it's a photograph taken by a street photographer of the time. And so I can, you know, it's a special day in their lives, but I can also see the street around them, the street scene, what people are wearing. And then that opens up this whole other area to explore of street photography, which is also really interesting. So there were photographers all around taking photos of people as they were going about their everyday business. And my nan told me many years ago that they would take your photo, they would give you a card with their studio address. You could go the next day to their studio and see the photo and purchase it if you wanted to, and which they did. And I have the original that they picked up that day. And she said you'd go into the studio and there'd be, you know, I guess what we would call thumbnails of all these photographs that they'd taken over the past few days. And something like that, whenever I talk about it to other family historians, it resonates with them because they have similar pictures, photographs in their own collection. It was quite a thing. And I love that connection that you then have through that one object.
I'm thinking about how many layers there are to that story, Cassie. There's this really personal story for you and your grandparents, and it's the day of their engagement, but it's also just literally a snapshot of a time of the sort of social mores of street photographers and what that street would have looked like. And you can still walk down George Street today and kind of see that shadow still there. Roxanne, what makes you decide what's right for a public collection like State Library of Victoria and what's best kept in a family collection?
So one of the things that I think is quite different about collecting this sort of material is that it may take years for us to talk to the family or the people who are in charge of the collection about that sensitive issue of what they want to keep and what is appropriate for the State Library. We often look for gaps because, as she said, the story of ordinary people is often not recorded in newspapers or books or any of the other material that we have. So we'll try and make sure that we cover a representative range of photographs, of diaries, of letters, of all sorts of material that tell us about the life of the time. And we have just marvellous conversations with people who inherit extraordinary things, whether it's of a working class seamstress who collected bits of everything that she sewed for 50 years and left them to her family. And when you unhouse them, it's a treasure house of what it was that was important at the time for ordinary people to wear, as well as photographs around that. So we try to talk to understand the stories, and the best is when we can get, as with Living's Watch, a family descendant who can tell us the story so that we can write it down so we know the context.
The stories you're telling me on the text line are just divine. James says, when my daughter was in primary school, she made me a leather key ring for Father's Day. It had my initials stamped into it. She's 34 now, and although I've had to repair it, it still has my house and car keys on it. Erica in Tasmania says, my keepsake is the small, plain, bright yellow badge I and other migrants had to wear on arrival in Sydney so that officials could identify us and shepherd us onto our next flight. That was 50 years ago. I will never throw it out. And Laura says, my mum has donated my grandfather's diaries from the 1930s and 1940s to the State Library of Victoria, along with corresponding photos and letters home to his mum in England from the early 1920s. He was sent from England to an uncle and aunt on the Victoria-New South Wales border as a 13-year-old. Crazy. Roxanne, I'm just so struck by the fact that all of these objects are physical, right? But so much of our memory making happens online these days. How is that changing the way libraries and museums are documenting our life and times?
Oh, it's truly an amazing challenge, and one that we really need engagement with the community to make sure that we're able to record it. So in the olden days, in the old, like 10 years ago, many community groups would produce newsletters, and they would send a copy to the library, and they would have stories of what was happening in their community, whether it was a regional area or a multicultural community, a school community, and we would lovingly put them into our print collection. These days, it's pretty much all done on Facebook or via email. So we have a number of ways we can collect that material through projects of called variously Ned and Pandora, and we'd love to continue to work much more with different communities. We're just coming up to an election. We used to collect badges and flyers. They're digital now, so we'll be very shortly running a campaign to encourage people to send that material to us so that we can deposit in the collection digitally.
So you're collecting memes?
Ooh, yes.
Amazing, amazing. Well, Cassie, not a meme. One of the things that you're exploring in your book is this idea of how we project meaning onto objects. And one of the things that's an important artifact is the miner's lamp. Tell me about that.
Yes. So when we came up with a concept for this book, we did a number of call-outs around the country, and we were looking for objects that have sparked a person's interest in their family history, because often for people that's a way in if they've inherited something or they come across something that they don't know much about. It can spark their interest. And one of them was a miner's lamp that through this one object we could connect, you know, the history of mining back in Wales, because the miner originated from Wales before he came over to New South Wales. And so we could dive into that migration of miners, the community that was built up around these mining communities, the camaraderie. And this lamp was really integral to his livelihood, and he used it every day in this, you know, dreadful, very hard life that he would have had. So all that meaning is attached to this one lamp. And we can then look back even further into First Nations history with coal and how they used it for fire, and they used the tar to line canoes and other things. So through that one object, which now sits on a mantelpiece, we can open up all these avenues of different understanding. And what I also like about it, and objects in general, is how the meaning changes over time. So what that original ancestor thought of that lamp, he probably, the day he put that down and didn't have to use it again, was probably a really happy day. He probably hated picking it up every day and putting his life at risk. But now to us, it's nostalgic. It's something that connects us. So that meaning changes over time as well, which I also really love.
So Roxanne, really briefly, this idea of meaning changing over time, maybe we don't get to choose what our ancestors, our descendants will find meaningful, but how do we kind of help them or curate what we hold on to?
So a couple of different levels here. It's about keeping the stories and being able to have a wonderful collection, 4.5 million items, so people can also see newspapers from the time, they can see books that people have written, as well as the photographs and the postcards, and being able to put that together and manage it in a collection. And the other really important challenge for us all is being able to make sure that they're preserved. So often we'll get material that might have had some experiences with insects. There might be glass negatives, which are incredibly fragile. So we have a very talented team of people that do conservation and preservation work to make sure that these things are preserved for future generations as well.
Well, Roxanne, Cassie, thank you so much. Roxanne Missingham, Chief Librarian at the State Library of Victoria, which will be opening its new exhibition, You Have a New Memory, on August 7. And Cassie Gilmartin, a family history writer, author of The Family History Book. Look out for her next book on exploring history through objects, which will be out next year. And thank you for your Artifact texts, they have just warmed my heart. This one, I have my great-grandmother's fork from Germany, which I eat with every day and think of her. It's not a very valuable fork, but she used to eat with it every day and mix the cabbage salad that she was frequently making, which I have also adopted. Well, it's Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Coming up next, how telling kids they can be anything can backfire. You can be anything you want to be when you grow up. You can do anything you set your mind to. Is that something you also heard growing up? Maybe you've said it yourself to encourage your own kids or grandkids. I got that a lot and it mostly served me well, but I came across a video recently where a young man really questioned that advice he was given.
I actually spent 6 months in a mental hospital for depression. I've had to realize that this narrative that I'd been brought up with, that I could do anything, just wasn't true.
So that was via Humans of New York on social media. The young man was talking about the pressure that that messaging put on him to be, in his words, Luke Skywalker or Jesus Christ. And it made me wonder if telling kids you can be anything you want to be is really an inspiring message or an impossible expectation. Well, I'm about to ask our resident psychologist about it, but I'd really love to hear your thoughts too. Were you told this as a kid? Did it feel encouraging or did it feel like pressure? How did childhood messages about success shape the choices you made? And here with me is Christine Bagley-Jones, our resident psychologist. She joins me fortnightly for Head and Heart. Christine, is this a phrase that you heard when you were growing up?
I did hear it, but also I thought that that was what I was supposed to deliver to my children when they were growing up. And I asked them about this very question, like, you know, how did it feel? Did I do that? And they were like saying, well, you did it in a fairly grounded way. You didn't let us have loopy, outlandish ideas about what they could achieve. So that's the thing that was a bit different.
So you got a gold star from the kids. That's always important. But this sense of like, you want your parents to believe in you. It feels like it's a vote of confidence, but at least for this person in the video, and I played the clip just now, it landed in a way of like impossible expectations.
That's right. And the point that you make about your kids and kids feeling that their parents believe in them can be very much achieved without pointing them in a direction where they've got these lofty, unrealistic fantasies about what they want to be or do in life.
Do you think that it's a relatively recent kind of message, like the last couple of generations? I don't know if parents 100 years ago were telling their kids, you can be anything you want to be. I think they were like, you're going to be a Chandler like your father and grandfather.
That's right. In fact, when you asked the question, did I grow up that way? I didn't. My parents didn't set up many expectations for what they wanted for me, which again had its downside because I didn't feel like I had guidance in terms of direction. So it's finding the sweet spot, really.
So what, like, okay, do you think it's a bad message to send?
In and of itself, it's coming from a place of love. It's just being naive. And when you want your kid to feel confident and aspirational, you want to make sure that you expand out. And it's not just your vocation, but it's the sort of person that you want to be. So you want to believe in them, but you want them to be wholehearted in the way they live their life. So it doesn't just have to be about what you're going to accomplish. It could be just the sort of person that you are. And you can believe in them in that way and nurture those qualities. So it is great to let someone know that they can have dreams and aspirations, but don't just narrow it to vocation. But also that realistic piece, that's really important too. Do the maths. Look at where their skills are. Look at where their interests lie. Let them know that whatever it is that they might want to be very successful at is going to include a lot of hours of hard yakka. Are they up for it? And also, I know this sounds a bit dry, but check out the likelihood. Like ask yourself, am I setting them up for disappointment? Are they really going to be the best in this particular area where, you know, you need to be elite, for example. So you want to be a bit rational about it.
I'm thinking about the Commonwealth Games are on at the moment, right? Like no one in those games is there by accident. Every single person there had extraordinary physical talent and then layered on top of that a huge amount of probably parental involvement and commitment. If you are going to be really great, you do need a lot of support and a lot of belief, self-belief. And so is it kind of, maybe do we just hedge our bets and say this in case your kid really can be anything and needs that backing to succeed?
I think you need to look at the resources available. You made a very valid point that if this kid really wants this, you've got to make sure that your community has that swimming pool that can they can go to train, for example, whether you've got the funds or the time. Or if you want to help your kid thrive, you've got to have the scaffolding to allow it. But also, like, let them give it a red hot go, but let them understand, let them have a very clear appraisal of what's included there. Their afternoons will be forfeited. They'll be training. These are the things that they need to weigh up, and maybe let them do a little try before they buy. And that's the thing I love, the idea of saying, yeah, of course, let's give it a shot, and let them actually kick that can down the road and then determine themselves, do I have the grit, do I have the willingness to sacrifice to become elite or really, really successful in a particular area? Because it's okay if they give it a go and then decide it's not for them or they want to try something different. It's okay to do lots and lots of tests and not define that as failing.
Yeah, I suppose it plays into this sense of what success looks like and that idea going along with these sorts of phrases are often things like we don't quit, you know, failure is not an option, that kind of thing. Are those potentially unhealthy things to be pushing after?
Again, it's a balancing act because you don't want someone to be so flippant that they keep just jumping from one interest to another, and because they're not instantly gratified or good at it, they ditch it for something else. So it's that application as well. Like, put some thought, do some research, then commit. Like, when my kids have wanted to try something, they've, you know, I want to do this. I'm like, okay, well, we're going to give it a year and you're going to throw yourself into it, and then we'll revisit whether it was right or wrong. So if you can, let them learn about how they operate in these spaces, because we can have these great fantasies. And of course, social media makes so many things seem more sexy than they really are. So once they're actually doing it, you'll see if they've got the aspirational drive to keep pushing, whether they've got the actual skills. Because remember, we're born with a certain lineup of strengths. And you want to speak to those strengths rather than picking something you don't have a natural talent for. And then you're up against those that do have that natural talent. So it's better to maximise on what you've already got naturally going on.
So James says, I put it a different way to my kids. I would say, aim for the stars, at least you'll hit the moon. Christine, do you like that?
I love it. I love it because you want them to dream big and you don't want to quell their imagination or that sense of, you know, I can think outside the square. I don't just have to do what my parents have done or what my cohort's doing. We want to have them experience a very unique and vibrant life, but we also don't want them to be faced with a devastating disappointment, which they'd like banked their entire identity on, like, I want to be this thing. And then if it doesn't happen, they don't just miss out on that opportunity. They've kind of lost who they are in the story. So always make sure that you buffer it with whatever you do. This isn't going to define you. There are so many other parts of who you are, which are rich and worthy of nurturing and celebrating.
Well, Christine, thank you so much for your advice. May today meet all of your realistic expectations. Christine Beckley-Jones joins me fortnightly for Head and Heart here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Well, that is just about it for Life Matters. I've come to you today from Jagera and Turrbal Land. Thank you so much for your text today. We were speaking earlier in the show about whether our current levers that we're pulling to curb smoking rates in Australia are still working. I was asking you how steep prices for legal tobacco and the availability of illicit tobacco affects you. One says, I stopped smoking in 1986 when cigarettes went up to $2 a pack and I smoked two packs a day. So money was a motivator. That and vanity. My mother said I'd end up with a cat's bum mouth when I got older. Another says, as a millennial living in Melbourne's inner north, I see more smoking around me than ever before. To my eyes, smoking is definitely on the rise among young people. Martha in Castlemaine says, if our government really wants smokers to quit, they should stop profiting from their tax, then sponsor free courses to quit. It is clear that it is a health issue. Well, you can go back and listen to that full chat. Just search Life Matters on ABC Listen and make sure you hit follow while you're there so you never miss an instalment. I'll be back with you again tomorrow. We're going to talk about the Summer of Lud, a Luddite festival in New York that's celebrating offlineness. And I want to know if you've ever tried to claw back a little bit of your pre-internet life, what that looked like. Plus, in a similar vein, Refidex, Gregory's, Melways, I don't know what you called yours, but that book of maps that used to sit in every car has fallen by the wayside now that we all have maps in our pockets on our phones, but they're not dead everywhere. And one of the oldest books on witch hunting from 1494 is heading to Australia. It's an insight into history, but it also echoes how we deal with scapegoats in our present. That's all coming up tomorrow on Life Matters. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'll catch you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.